Hey everyone, Andrew here. Just giving you a heads up that in this episode, we will be discussing some recent events that have taken place in Israel and Palestine, and we will be including discussions of violence and genocide. If you find that sort of content disturbing, I have now advised you, you may do with that as you see fit. Now on with the show. Welcome back to Seemingly Unrelated. We are the podcast that takes these little stories from everyday life and threads them together into the major movements of history, culture, politics, society, whatever you want to call it. I am your host, Dr. Andrew Johnson, still a lecturer in media, culture, and society at the University of Glasgow. And joined, as always, is the DJ on the ones and twos. It's our producer, Naomi. Naomi, how are you doing this week?
I'm good, thank you. I've actually just been teaching a DJ course, so I've been hearing seven songs play all at the same time for the last 9 hours. So you've caught me at a very good time.
Excellent. We've got a little bit of a different episode this week. So as everyone knows who listens to the show, we come out fortnightly every other week. And so that means usually we have two episodes in a month, but this September, when this launches, there are three Tuesdays that fall into our schedule. So I decided, let's do something a little bit different. What's happening at the end of September? And I realize that we are overlapping with the Jewish high holidays. So this week's guest is a special guest in that they're the one who knows what's happening instead of me. We're throwing things around.
Andrew's the dummy in this episode.
I'm the dummy this time. So please, without further ado, welcome our special guest, Dr. Ophira Gamliel. Hello, Ophira. How are you doing?
Thank you. Nice to be here.
So if you wouldn't mind, please, just a little introduction for yourself so that the audience knows why they should be super excited for this episode.
I'm not sure I can sell this point very well, I'm afraid, but I can introduce myself. So I'm senior lecturer at the University of Glasgow in the theology and religious studies, and I specialize on South Asian religions, broadly speaking. Specifically, I am studying South India and especially Judaism in South India for about 2 decades, a little bit more than that, even though I started with Sanskrit, so complete idol worshipping. It's if not for the Jews of South India, I'd probably not vote for Judaism in the first place. But I am a Jew, so I do know something about Judaism. And not only that, I am also a native Hebrew speaker. I was born and raised in Israel. My father, his name was Jamil Jamal. He was born in Yemen, and he, you can say, a Zionism survivor, migrated to Israel, even though his family didn't want to leave, at least his father. And my mom is a Holocaust survivor. She was born in Amsterdam just a year before the Nazis occupied the Netherlands. So yeah, that's a little bit about my own background. I left Israel 10 years ago, a little bit more than 10 years ago, completely resolved never to return.
Yeah.
Yeah. And maybe we can talk about that a little bit later.
Absolutely. Absolutely. A difficult choice for sure to make, but I sympathize as someone who left his homeland for not quite the same reasons, but nearly 10 years ago. I also had some political objections to something that happened 10 years ago that maybe has made me sympathize with your position. So absolutely great to have you. I think you've got a great perspective and it fits well with our show's whole shtick on the idea of seemingly unrelated. So, like I said, this episode falls right around the high holidays. So we're coming in the very end of September. So Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur are what, about 2 days, I think, to Yom Kippur, and then 10 days from there. Am I doing it right? Anyway, you're the expert. What am I talking about? What are Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur? What do the high holidays generally mean?
Yeah, okay. So I always have also to check online so I don't make any mistakes. You really need to be, immersed in practicing Judaism in order to be able to tell you what is the Hebrew date right now. So it's not exactly now. It changes from year to year. You know, I always say Jews are more like Muslims.
Yeah.
For some strange reason, everybody thinks that the Jews are some sort of Christians. No, we are some sort of Muslims.
Yeah. Well, and we actually talked about this in our New Year's episode, how Islam and Judaism both use this lunar system. That's a little bit different.
Exactly. I'm glad you've been there already, so I don't have to explain. See, you are a bigger expert than actually you present yourself. Rosh Hashanah, the new year, is, literally speaking, it's the head of the year. Okay. Oh. Yes, head is the beginning of something. And it is in 22nd of September. So thank you for that, because I do have to remember to tell everybody. Happy New Year. And it is 2 days. And then you have 10 days doing all kinds of, you know, repentance, etc., until Yom Kippur.
And by repentance, how would you describe it?
You do all kinds of special prayers in the synagogue when you, and I have to kind of apologize for my ignorance. So my father and we would always, you know, fast in Yom Kippur. We would go with him as kids to the synagogue, etc. But we would play. And the women would sit, you know, in their attic and will gossip. And the men will have to carry this burden of reciting the prayers. It's very tedious. And going to the synagogue. And again, it's a little bit relaxed. It's not like too hectic.
Yeah. Well, this is like me as a kid. My father was the choir director at our church. And he would go off, he'd like do all the hard work of the hymns and whatnot. And I would watch Looney Tunes, which was my church. My church was at the foot of Porky Pig, which is not kosher, but that's a different story altogether.
Yeah. So that was kind of to say, I'm not sure what they do in the synagogue exactly. And a lot of stuff happens at home. The meals are at home. Like Jewish life is very much home-centric. I think if you ask me, the beautiful thing about Judaism is its ability to adapt to different places very quickly and create networks. And the synagogue is only there if you have enough adult males, so you need a proper community. But sometimes you might have, like in South India, that would happen, but also elsewhere, you might have people, you know, living in kind of small ad hoc communities, not necessarily having a synagogue or having a home as a synagogue. It can move. So I think this is one of the reasons why a lot of the rituals that would have been associated in biblical times, you know, which is also a big question about the historicity. But let's say at least in Herod times, there was a temple in Jerusalem, right? So there will be a lot of sacrifices and rituals done in the temple. And there, at some point, these were converted, you can say, into home rituals. So the table at home is kind of perceived as a ritual place.
That's fascinating, because you're right, it's very much in contrast, I think, to the Christian tradition, where because Christianity's, I would say, not its main principle, its main principle is supposed to be about a cycle of forgiveness and resurrection, but I would say its next closest thing is consumption, right? Wherever Christianity sets up, it brings its stuff there and it makes it very public, right? All of the Christian holidays happen out in the open, in the public. You know, if it's Easter, there's a procession. And then if it's Christmas, it's at the shopping mall. So like that's its whole evolution, right? It's just been consuming. So it's very interesting to see to think in terms of, oh, Judaism brings it home. It keeps it tight. Effectively, very different.
Yeah.
So you've mentioned a few times the idea of the South Indian Jewish communities. I was wondering if you could elaborate. I think for a lot of our listeners, they're unaware, right, of the prevalent or substantial Jewish populations outside of either Europe or North America. So just a little background. Who are the Jews of South India?
Okay, so the Jews of South India are the Jews of the Islamicate world, if you like, or the Arabo-Persian world, more the Arab world than anything else. Global history is one of the things it does is looking into the sea, looking into the oceans as the stage of unfolding histories, as oceans as connecting continents, connecting lands, and breaking through the nationalistic paradigms that we have about histories. So you can say that there were a lot of Jews in West Asia. Okay, that's right. Looking from the Indian Ocean perspective. In India, they don't say Middle East. They say West Asia.
It's funny to think, gee, I wonder why they say the West Asia. It's almost as if Middle East, who could have come up with that term?
Yeah, it's very Eurocentric, no, to talk mm-hmm. about the Middle East. There is a Far East and there is a Middle East, and you know, so it's you can also speak about the Arabic speaking world, if you like, which has also, by the way, a lot of Christians right. that are always somehow forgotten. So how do we get to South India? Again, if you start thinking about, okay, if the Middle East is West Asia, oh, what's the problem about Jews being in South India, right?
So the idea being that Jews move out from their original sort of part of the world, where they come from, sort of Egypt and into the Middle East, air quotes, in all directions. We tend to think that they sort of move into Europe, but that's not true. And
if I can just kind Please. Of revise it a little bit.
Thank you.
The idea that Jews were, you know, originated in one place and scattered throughout the world at some period is a little bit, you know, kind of misleading, I can say. Mm-hmm. I don't blame you for thinking like that because that's how they like to present it, right? There were Jews in Egypt from very early times, also in Djerba, also in Italy, also in Yemen. We're talking about second century common era that we have the earliest evidence for synagogue, etc., etc., in such different places across the Asian and Mediterranean worlds.
Right.
Okay. Yeah. And one of the things in order to understand the kind of perspectives, at least I'm looking at Jewish history, is from the perspective of global history, not the nationalist Zionist history. So we forget about empires. We forget about the story that we are told about empires. And we look at merchant communities, trader communities, those communities, also slaves.
Yeah. So then essentially there's almost a contiguous network of community. There is no, yes, there are Jews, there are Malabar Jews and there are Syrian Jews and there are, but there aren't. They're also just people across oceans.
For example, one of the most famous traders in the Geniza, his name is Abraham Benijou. His family is originally from Tunisia and they migrated to Fustat for whatever reason. Eventually they moved to Sicily. One of them, Abraham Benijou, went to the Malabar coast in the 12th century, stayed there for 17 years, and married a woman who was obviously not a Jew.
Sure.
Okay. But he had children, and he wanted to return to Aden and then to Egypt with his children without his wife. Okay? So he returned without his wife, and he had two children, and his community members in Yemen said that his children are not Jewish.
Right.
Because the mother was not Jewish.
Their mother wasn't Jewish.
Yeah.
That's why my granddad was Jewish, but then he came across in the Second World War as a refugee from Czechoslovakia. But then because my grandma wasn't Jewish. We weren't considered to be Jewish.
By whom?
I think he converted to Christianity, maybe from some of the trauma of what he'd been through. I think none of his children considered themselves to be Jewish.
What is Jewishness exactly? Is it an ethnicity? Is it a religion? What puts all Jews together is a question that I am not sure anybody reached very concrete answers.
It's interesting you say that, because I think the way I was taught it in school is in a way that it was sort of an ethnicity, maybe, that say if you're mother is Jewish, whether you believe in the religion, you are considered Jewish. I've always been confused around that.
Isn't it
topic.
Confusing? What yeah. does it have to do with the mother? If it's an ethnicity, then why mother and not father?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Right? And it's kind of bizarre, right? I think it has to do with the standardization of what religion is and race and putting people into boxes in, you know, during the late 19th century, the height, you know, of colonial period. It has to do with academia, and then it has to do with, you know, objectifying and making these objects of study. You can say study of Judaism started earlier. And it started with the Jews around them. I'm looking into the history of the Jews in Kerala. One merchant, which is mentioned in the records from the 1530s, is Isaac the Cairo, right? Which is okay. Isaac of Cairo.
Yeah.
Around that period, you have a letter in Hebrew sent from Cochin to the great rabbi of Cairo, asking him, oh, we have a problem here with the two communities of the, you know, people. These people say that these people didn't marry properly, right? The issue with, they got women that were concubines or slave girls, and they had sons born to them, and they didn't convert them properly. So we are the real Jews. They are not the real Jews, you know, and they don't want to marry with them, and they keep on fighting about it. Can you tell me how to deal with this, you know? And this is because this history of like 3-4 centuries of intermarriages, kinship networks with women who may not be Jewish, you know, but right. they got married to a Jew, and the father teaches the children, born on the Malabar coast. And I know from my Yemeni family that also they had similar stories in Yemen, like they used to bring African ladies from Ethiopia or the region of the Red Sea and convert them and marry them and bring them to Yemen. So we have also a lot of people in my family who look more like Africans than, you know, Arabs or Yemenis.
The rule that we hear, which is effectively that must be the mother in reality.
Exactly.
possibly all time until very recently, just wasn't happening. People were just sort of smoothing around the edges.
Of course not. And then you have to think, okay, so when they're talking about the Jewish gene, what are they talking about? Are they serious? You know, what is this rubbish?
Yeah, I see what you mean now. Because if you're always marrying new people and converting them, then it's not, oh, everyone's in the same gene pool.
That's okay. I just want to note, because I always wondered, a thing that used to be taught to me was that the genetic disorder Tay-Sachs was more common in Jewish populations because Jewish populations tend to breed internally. They stay within the Jewish population. And I always thought, if you're only marrying Jews, at some point in time, you become like the Habsburgs and you're inbreeding, right? But you're saying, well, that's because no, that's not what
anyone was
doing.
That's not what was happening.
They were marrying people. They were living life.
We have, you know, endless debates about the Jewish origins of communities, including Yemen, and a lot of, well, they say, I don't know genetics, and I'm very suspicious about it. I don't think you can find culture and history in the genes. And it's really smirks of racism, you know?
Yeah, and we were talking about that with 23andMe and stuff, weren't we? That these websites that are saying they can find out where you're from based on your genes actually are just basing it on the pool of people that sent it from that area. So it's like,
It's neo-eugenics.
It doesn't like make any sense, basically.
It's terrible, really. But anyway, so I don't like to tell Jewish, but what they did both to Yemenis, you know, they say like, Yemeni Jews don't have the Jewish genes.
What a statement.
only they had a synagogue there from second century for Common Era. So, see, you are talking with a genetically non-Jew.
Right.
I don't have the Jewish gene from my father's side. I don't have the Jewish gene from my Ashkenazi mother's side, because the Portuguese Jews of Amsterdam, they do have the Jewish gene. I don't understand this, you know. I mean, I don't care if somebody wants to rule out my Jewishness because I'm a daughter of a Yemeni Jew. I'll tell them, you're a racist.
Yeah.
My father already learned to read the Bible when he was 4 or 5 years old from each direction of the book that you will not put it, you know, because they had only one book, because they used handwritten manuscripts. They didn't have Bible prints. They insisted on, you know, copying their Bibles, etc. So they had one big book for a group of children. So they had to read Hebrew from left to right, from right to left, from upside down, and from every direction.
Yeah. So then, like you were saying, that these other sort of Europeans, they're studying, they start to really try to understand, quote unquote, scientifically, the Jewish people. So then, is this sort of unitary vision of Jewishness that we have today, is this something you think maybe was externally brought on?
My point is the way that we perceive Judaism today, and it's very similar to the way we perceive Hinduism or Buddhism or even Islam, is very much shaped by 3 or 4 centuries of a gradual kind of, how shall I put it, taking over of the study of religions. Some scholars argue that the conceptualization of religions and world religions was really kind of coming into being in the 19th century. But I think that the perception of what Judaism is, and the idea that there is the Bible and this is Jewish history, and after the Bible we kind of skip immediately to the Holocaust, this is something that started taking place in the 16th century with the attempts of rationalizing the global, you know, world, the Indian Ocean, the trade, etc., etc., the geography, and the knowledge that was handed down from the, you know, Greeks to the Arabs and back to Europe, that this kind of knowledge is, you know, verifiable by the Bible and interpreted by the Bible and by messianic interpretations of the Bible. And that leads us to the current moment in which we basically face the erasure of Jewish history, which is very much the hand in hand with the erasure of the Arab history of Palestine, Palestinian history, and Palestinians. I think it all goes down to the 16th century.
So this gradually changing identities, it brings me back then to the story of the High Holidays as I understand them. So that 10-day period, as I've always been told, is sort of the Jewish time of atonement. And I was wondering, Ophira, if A, that is a thing that has changed, if there's any kind of antecedent to that being a part of the High Holidays. Is there any difference between atonement in this context and sort of like penance or forgiveness or these concepts?
So Judaism is one of those religions, like Zoroastrianism, that is organized, and Brahminism, Hindu Brahminism, that is organized around purity.
Okay.
Purity and pollution.
Oh, okay. So
right? So some of the customs that I remember from, you know, being a child and growing into a Jewish state, which already we established that there is some misconception of what Judaism is within the state of Israel, within Zionism. So you purify, not so much in the sense of you did a sin and you have to confess, that you have to torment yourself for, or, you know, this idea of, again, I don't know enough about Christianity, correct me if I'm wrong, but there is this ongoing shadow of a primordial sin that is, you know, part yep. of your existence as a human being.
Well, both right? Naomi and I nodding heads. Yeah, yeah, no, no, that's what I grew
yes,
up with.
Yes, we're all sinners. Yep.
yeah. So that is not there. You lived in the world and all kinds of disgusting, polluting right. stuff sticks to you. Some of it is, you know, internal, like thoughts or, you know, or deeds. Or some of it is like materials out there in the world. And Judaism also is different from Islam and from Christianity because it has this, you know, issue with 316 commandments, right?
Right.
It's not just 10 commandments.
Not just 10.
It's 300.
That is a lot to remember.
Oh, who remembers?
That's apparently that's what the whole everything in the what I've been told is everything in the Torah, which is also basically the same stuff in the Old Testament. It's all basically commandments. Like every story is basically ending in.
Oh my
here's
god!
Here's a commandment.
It's exhausting.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm tired even thinking about it, like. Having to remember 300 and, was it 10?
16.
16. Even not even 10.
Yeah. There's six more to
things.
Put. Yeah. I don't know what we're supposed to learn from turning people into pillars of salt, but I'm sure that there's a commandment somewhere in there.
I don't think about that, but no, the commandments also, you know, I'm not sure how they found, I mean, there is Leviticus and Deuteronomy. I think these are the books that have all those, you know, you should do this and you should do that. And, yeah, you think about it. Sorry, I mean, I'm a religious studies scholar, but I have very difficult relationship with God. And I think, what is this God so petty, you know? And I think that, I think this is probably part of what Muslims, you know, and Christians thought when they encountered the Jewish God and these, you know, Jewish issues. You know, say, okay, we have to simplify the matter. But, but 316 commandments or mitzvot, you know, one of the things that the observant Jews say to each other when they greet each other, a greeting, you know, is, oh, may you merit, you know, may you merit the commandments.
So then is there almost a level of acceptance that you're going to be polluted over the year? And it's not that you are like, I need to atone or I need to cleanse because I'm bad. It's more of a like, I need to take a bath. It's the same way as like when you go to the gym, right? Like you're going to get sweaty and gross. You know, you need to shower. Is then the quote atonement, the cleansing a part of a almost practical approach to what Christians would call sins, but which Jews are effectively calling commandments?
So, okay, I looked up the Bible. Let's go back to the Bible, even though, you know, biblical literalism
right
is
there.
Dangerous.
I yeah. got a study Bible right there.
Okay, I have it there open where the Day of Atonement is first mentioned. And you have to remember that these texts were shaped by contacts with Mesopotamian and Egyptian religions. And probably Zoroastrianism and yes. Manichaeism as well. Zoroastrianism is older than Judaism and also Egyptian religions and Mesopotamian religions.
And I should just note for anyone listening who doesn't know, very quickly, Zoroastrianism is a religion mostly associated with Persia in the from about the 5th or 6th century BCE, I think is when it pops up. And it has a lot of the trappings of what we think of as Christianity. But in it, there is a person named Zoroaster who is sort of this enlightened, not quite a messiah, but very similar tracking to messiah. And it was just the dominant religion in Persia. And during the Achaemenid dynasty, yes, Cyrus the Great defeats the, I want to say, Neo-Babylonians. And one of Cyrus's big things was he wouldn't force people to convert to Zoroastrianism, but he would incentivize people to convert to Zoroastrianism. So when he takes out the Babylonians, the Jewish peoples of that part of the world, because as we've already noted, there's a lot more Jews everywhere, but the ones in what we would today call, quote, the Middle East, they're like, ooh, Cyrus seems like a good guy. Like, he's not forcing us to convert, and he got rid of the people who didn't like us. So that's why Zoroastrianism is often, that's the norm, that's the sort of mainstream story, is that that's why Zoroastrianism has such a powerful influence on Judaism.
So the Jews of, you say, Babylonia and Babylonian, but actually it's Iraq, right? Or what is called Mesopotamia. And they had religions for, you know, 2 millennia before Christ, before Common Era. We have to remember that Judaism and the Bible were shaped in that environment.
Yes. So we're left then with saying, okay, if we're questioning this, what is Jewishness? We've got a counter presentation for the ethnicity, because the matrilineal line that we've all come to know, there's plenty of counterexamples to that.
Mm-hmm.
The religious aspect seems to be like, okay, well, which Judaism are you talking about? Because as you said, the biblical interpretations, that's different than necessarily, like that changes over time. So I was wondering if you could briefly give, as a child of Israel, perhaps a little background for our listeners. What is Zionism, and how has it been influential on the Jewish identity in the modern era?
Well, the previous chapter, we finished in the 16th century, and I would argue that that's the beginning, and that this beginning has to do with religious demarcation of European Christians and European Jews. There is an evolution of what is currently termed the Judeo-Christian heritage.
Yeah.
Putting a hyphen between Jews and Christians, but excluding the Muslims from this knowledge system and belief system. But they didn't call it Judeo-Christian until the 19th century. And in the 19th century, the term was first coined by an anti-Semite in German. So, and then slowly it evolves. And after the Second World War, it was kind of appropriated in the US as a reaction to the Holocaust, and then by Germany. And then there is this idea today, we live with an idea of a Judeo-Christian heritage without Muslims. And the Judeo there is very much European Judaism, but modern European Judaism.
I just want to note, Naomi, I think World War II was just mentioned, which means once again,
ding, ding, ding,
ding, ding, ding, bingo card.
We talk about it in every episode.
In every episode, every single episode, it has to come up. You're saying that not the coining of the term, but the popularization of Judeo-Christian, of the connection between Jewishness and Christianity being made verbally explicit, is a direct result of the Holocaust and the guilt or the failures of Christians to be involved, but at least some sort of it comes out of World War II.
Well, that's what scholars say. I would argue that this kind of the Judeo-Christianization of Judaism and of Jewish history started before that, started and has a lot to do with colonialism, like we have to go back there, and has a lot to do with erasure. How come the churches around the world don't say anything about the genocide or avoid talking about the genocide?
Right.
And Christian leaders are very careful about talking about the genocide. There were 3 or 4 churches in Gaza, and there are churches in Palestine today, and nobody's protecting them because they are Palestinians. So is it a different Christianity? What's wrong with you? I mean, don't you want to protect them?
Right. So it becomes a framing then of the Jewish political identity, and then that being attached to the region and political considerations taking precedent over either ethnic considerations or religious considerations as they might exist.
So maybe we can talk about geopolitical, but to me it's difficult because what is happening in the past 2 years doesn't make sense. It's suicidal.
Yeah.
Is it rational? What happened to the legal system that we have? Totally collapses. What happens to liberal democratic values or even, you know, Christian values, if you like, or, you know, liberal or progressive values or whatever? Why are we, what gets us stuck? And I think it's partly because of this idea that our civilization is kind of based on this Judeo-Christian heritage, and this Judeo-Christian heritage is very white. It's also racist.
Yeah.
So, for example, how many people, you know, would I, if I walk down the street, how many people would think I am a Jew? There is no way Jewish people look. Yes. And of course, this is, but the image of a Jew nowadays is of a white person.
Yeah.
And, you know, I got to say that this kind of discrimination, it's even just because I am a dark person. I look like an Arab, and I am half Arab, right? Like my father is from Yemen. It makes me a lesser Jew.
Right.
And Jews of color, if you go back to India, that's very interesting. You know, that's part of my journey into the 16th century and to understand what happens in the 16th century is because the history of Indian Jews always starts with there were two communities in Kerala. There were white Jews and black Jews. And the white Jews are actually exiles from the Iberian Peninsula. Problem is that that goes against the evidence.
Right.
And the white Jews are from Iraq.
Right.
You know, so you think, how is an Iraqi Jew becoming white in the... The earliest evidence I found for this kind of distinction between white and black Jews in these words is from 1781. The 1770s, okay? By this Yehezkel Rahabi, a Jew whose ancestry is from Aleppo. And he is writing to the Jews of Amsterdam and he says, we have two communities here. We have the black Jews and the white Jews. And of course, he's from the white Jews.
Right.
Why? He was a merchant, a shrewd merchant.
He's appealing to a white supremacist society and trying to say, I'm one of the good ones.
Exactly.
Yikes.
Do you know what I keep thinking about is, I don't know if you've seen like the Louis Theroux episode where he meets the Nazis in America, the white supremacists. Yeah. And he said it's the most uncomfortable he's ever felt in his career when he was sat in one of their garages. And they were saying, they've been sort of hanging out with them all evening. They're all quite drunk. And it suddenly flips the atmosphere. And they say, actually, are you Jewish? Because you look Jewish.
Wow. And he was a Jew, no?
No.
No?
He's not. But he refused to tell them if he was or not.
Okay,
because he didn't want to... He didn't want to be like, no, I'm not. Like seeming like it was a thing to be defensive over. So he just said, I'm not going to tell you. And then they said, actually thinking about you really do look Jewish. I bet you are Jewish. So this in their heads, Louis Theroux is what a Jewish person looks like. This a white guy with darker hair and, you know, all of this stuff. The features, he says, he looks Jewish. And he was worried he was going to get killed. Actually, I think he said he was very uncomfortable.
It's frightening, especially
when they're drunk. It's interesting to see their thoughts on like what a Jewish person is in a white supremacist eyes.
So that Jewish whiteness then, if the first documented evidence that you're aware of and you're a scholar, but up to now, this is the earliest appearance of this white Jewishness is immediately self-preservation. It's immediately an attempt to do business in a space that was, you know, because if we're talking about the 1770s,
it's a process of erasure. And if you want to go back to Palestine, and if you want to go back to atonement and to thinking about, you know, what kind of stuff, if I may, you know, to think about it from the perspective of what are those 10 days and what is, you know, the new year, Rosh Hashanah, the head of the year, and Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, and all this idea of purifying and reflecting on what have you collected, you know, on your being that you need to kind of shed off before you stand before your Lord. The whole idea, again, it's very old. It's coming from even Egyptian religions, you know, that mm-hmm. when you die, there is this culture of, you know, okay, what really worries me is what happens after death, right? And after, at the time of death, according to the ancient Egyptians, there are different parts of the human psyche or soul, if you like, or consciousness that starts falling apart. And there's the heart. The heart is actually the seat of thought and knowledge. And the heart accumulates during your life. It accumulates, it registers all kinds of things that you go through, experiences, deeds, etc., etc. And when you reach the gates of this other world, right, there is this god Anubis, if I remember correctly, who mm-hmm. stands there and weighs, they have like a scale and they weigh yeah. your heart. And if your heart is too heavy at the time of death, then you are kind of doomed, you know? You can't right. really pass to the journey.
You have to weigh it against a feather, I believe, is the...
The feather, thank yeah. you. Yes, that's good.
So there's this sense then, it seems, amongst, at least in the more mainstream Jewish communities, there is a kind of a desire to wash away those impurities so that it kind of doesn't matter what you did, right? You can stand on that day at that time at the head of the year and say, yes, I am good enough. I am pure enough. I am ready for whatever happens next.
So what happens, according to the traditions, at least, these are some oral traditions, is that at the Day of Atonement, you know, everybody is in the synagogue and they are praying and they have all those prayers that were composed actually in Baghdad, you know, heart of the Arabic speaking world. That's where the prayers were composed that also Ashkenazi Jews, European Jews recite. And they recite them. And then there is this, you know, idea that at the end of the day, it's such a special day, there is this moment in which heavens kind of open and that you really have to stand there with a pure heart. And it's a cyclical thing, right? Every year it happens. Your heart has to be pure. Of course, your clothes, they wear white. The tradition is to wear yeah. white during that holiday. And yeah, to be honest, in Rosh Hashanah of 2022, I think it was, we had some kind of celebration. I did it for some friends. One of them is half Jew, like you, mm-hmm. you know, father was a Jewish, mother or grandfather was, grandfather and grandmother were Jews. Father was a Jew, his mother not Jew. So he's not saying I am a Jew, but he wants to learn about Judaism, right? I said, okay, let us have a fun, you know, Rosh Hashanah meal and I'll show you how we do and all the little prayers over the food items. As I told you, the table is like a ritual ground. And we went into that. October 7 was in Simchat Torah. It's the end of the High Holy Days. Mm-hmm. I think in 24, he asked me, why don't we do another Rosh Hashanah? You know, I said, I don't feel like it. Sorry. I don't want to yeah. celebrate any of the Jewish holidays. I feel completely alienated as if, to me, it feels the death of Judaism. It's an old religion. It happens. It happened to Zoroastrianism. It happened to Manichaeism. It happens to Judaism now. If it becomes the whole religion, the whole thing, its whole history is completely geared towards a genocide, it's the end.
Yeah. There's no lightness in that heart. I don't know how much water it would take to cleanse genocide. I don't think we have enough on the planet, in my opinion.
Let's say that the past 100 years of Zionism is not good for Judaism. It standardized it. It uprooted it. It displaced. It completely messed up what is Jewish indigeneity, ethnicity, if you like. But my father's family were indigenous of Yemen. They must have been there for a few hundred years, you know, settled there as Yemenis my grandfather didn't want to leave. And all Asian Jewries and North African Jewries, they were basically erased. And not only that the communities were displaced, mass displaced, but their histories were erased because the European, you know, Zionists especially told the, you know, tried to approve. This is one of the things that, you know, Ella Shochat argues very convincingly is how Zionist historians basically meddle up our histories, erase them. But now all our communities, whether it is the Black Jews of India or the White Jews of India, you know, that kind of, how you say, appropriated, you know, assimilated, this kind of categories laid on them. It's kind of sad. Or my father's communities, and to a certain extent also my mother's communities in Amsterdam, you know, they are all, we are a small nation, you can say, whatever it's a diasporic nation or whatever, you know, you want to define it. But most of us are currently recruited into this idea, you know, that they are doing something good. It's awful. And as somebody who knows about Jewish history, it's shocking because, no, I'm sorry, that's not what Judaism is about. There are so many, you know, you can find in Jewish scriptures, in the Bible, in Halacha, in Talmud, in Mishnah, in all, you know, the periods, you can find a lot of references to kind of warn you against this. Tell you, you must respect the nations. You cannot just break international law like this. It is a catastrophic. It's bad for you. You live with nations, you must respect the nations. For example, you know, I don't want to present Judaism as some kind of a fluffy, spiritual, blah, blah religion. No, I think it's wrong. Every religion has, you know, beautiful face, spiritual, if you like. They have, you know, the spiritualized face also for, you know, us modern people living in a postmodern world. And all religion has, you know, violence. I mean, you see, Buddhists can become genocidal, right? In Myanmar with the Rohingya. So it's not something that is special to Judaism, but Judaism is a small religion. We don't have so many people. And when you have 90% of the self-defined Jews in the world today supporting a genocide, denying the genocide, only 80 years after we emerged out of the ashes, I don't know what to say. You know, I think it's like the first genocide in world's history that is going to register also like a collective suicide. This is what it seems to me.
So I know you left, did you say 10 years ago you left Israel? And you talk about this sort of, I don't know if it's the right word, but brainwashing of the Jewish people there of like, this is a good thing that we're doing sort of thing. How common is it that people feel the way you do there?
I would like to think about myself as mainstream. Mm-hmm. I can't understand why is it radical to be against a genocide. Genocide is the radical, most radical position that can be taken. It really beggars belief. And you're asking me how many people I have friends. I have friends in Israel. I have friends who left Israel in the past 2 years. I have, you know, I met new friends, whether it is on Twitter or on, you know, different networks of dissident Israelis and progressive Jewish groups. And it's difficult, but the problem is that, you know, and that's why I left Israel, because I felt like there are so many cognitive dissonances. And we have Palestinian citizens of Israel, we live with them. And only when I started traveling to India, I realized how completely, I don't want to use bad words, but how badly the whole country is structured socially, organizationally, even, you know, in the landscape. There is this amazing, I don't know if you heard about forensic architecture.
No,
I haven't.
Check it up. There is this scholar, he's an architect. I'm not sure exactly which brand, but academic. So maybe also geography. I'm not sure what is his academic field, but he is the founder. His name is Eyal Weitzman. He was born in Haifa, which is what they call in Israel mixed city.
Okay. Right, right.
When meaning. You know, what is a mixed city, right?
Yeah.
When you are in India, is all the cities are mixed. You have Muslims and Hindus and, you know, Christians everywhere, right? There are not, you don't have a city for Jews and a city for, but there are some mixed cities, you know, in Israel. The whole concept is bizarre.
Yeah, that's very odd to me, especially living in Manchester, where it's like you would never class it as like a mixed city, but obviously, like, just because you assume every city is going to have lots of different people living in
That's
it.
That's the whole point of
There's
a cities.
Point of a city, yeah.
That's what cities do.
Yeah.
What is a mixed city? You don't think about it only when you have to translate it to English.
Mm.
Yeah.
And this is a common phrase in Hebrew. So there are those mixed cities where you have to, you know, plan so the Muslims learn in their schools and the Jews learn in the schools and religious Jews learn in their school and this. So it's like a system of apartheid within apartheid within apartheid. Mm-hmm. And you can grow up without ever properly, you know, sitting and speaking to a Palestinian.
Mm-hmm.
They learn about us. They have to learn Hebrew. We don't have to learn Arabic. And we don't learn, you know, we don't listen to them. And in 2011, with the Arab Spring, and there was this, you know, protest movement in Israel, I wanted to listen. I thought, there's an opportunity to change. Let us get rid of this occupation. People out in the street, they shout social justice, right? Social justice means getting rid of the occupation. I mean, what's so difficult? And I was not a very political person, but I just lived my life, you know? And then I started moving in the country and listening to people. And I got, you know, to listen to a group of Marxist Palestinians from the Galilee and to, you know, just listen to them. Let them talk, you know, what happened? What are the suicide bombers, you know, the Oslo agreements, ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta. And then I realized that we are living in a lie because we don't acknowledge the Nakba. We don't acknowledge that the Palestinian citizens of Israel still have family members in Gaza, in Lebanon, in refugee camps in Jordan, distant family members that they haven't seen. They live with a pain that they are not allowed to even talk about. They insist that they insist on the right of return, that no Jew wants to talk about. I also looked at the language, you know, I'm also a linguist. So I looked at, you know, the numbers of how many native Hebrew speakers, how many native Arabic speakers or other, you know, how many native speakers do we have in the region since 1922, when the Balfour, you know, declaration, and there was an order to make Hebrew an official language. Maybe there were a few dozens of native Hebrew speakers in Palestine when they said it is the official. Why should they make it an official language? And then I realized we are a minority and we are trying to force a majority in any means possible. And this is violent. And unless we acknowledge it, first of all, when you realize it, you can't remain a Zionist. You know?
Yeah. And it is, you know, it has become, as you say, the accepted narrative. It has become the default. And I will note that even in Europe, not all Jews adopted Zionism when it came to them. And there was strong resistance in places like Dubrovnik and Sarajevo and Belgrade and Salonika, also known as Thessaloniki. And then 1941 rolled around, and that resistance, those people who did not embrace Zionism, they did not exist anymore. So genocide helped Zionism become the only narrative that is really being presented.
Do you know, I have one thing to say. It really reminds me of, I'm trying to relate it to things that I've experienced, obviously on a much smaller scale, but I grew up in a really small town but in Essex, it was just like white people. I always thought that I was in from a really broad-minded background, and I was very left, and I really understood a lot of the issues. And then BLM sort of started being talked about. And I can't believe I'm admitting this, but I think I was like, I don't think that we have a huge problem with racism anymore, though, in England. Like, it's quite equal and stuff like that. And it's exactly what people say about women. There's no misogyny in England like men might say about women. Until you're a woman, until you've gone through it, or until you spoke to women, you wouldn't understand what we're going through. And it was like, until I started speaking to Black people about what they've been through, of course I think there isn't any racism, because I live in a white area where I don't talk to anyone who's Black, and I don't see racism because I'm white, so I'm not going to see it. So when you were talking about the whole time, I was thinking about me in school and about when you were saying there's this separation where Jewish people aren't talking to the Palestinians, and you're just never learning about the history of Palestinians and never talking to them. And it's like, yeah, how would you ever come to understand the genocide if you don't ever interact with the people?
And then, Naomi, the interesting thing will be, of course, when we get to the other side, because we will, all right, everything is temporary. And I don't know what the other side looks like. I've got a hope, but I don't know what the other side's going to look like. Then I imagine that the same thing might happen here in Palestine that happened where I'm from, which is the southern United States, where we went through apartheid. We did that. We called it Jim Crow. We gave it an extra special name. And when I was a kid, I was taught how great we white people were for ending the apartheid that we started. That we would point to the fact that I went to my middle school, my junior high school, Macy's Lane, used to be the Black high school. And in the front lobby was all the winning football team trophies of the Black high school and all these things. And was the story of and now it's great because now it's mixed and there's Black kids and there's white kids and you're all studying together now. Isn't it great that happened, that we did that? And you go, well, hold on a minute. But who started in the first place? And I think I imagine that on the back end of this, I again hope when reason prevails, that is exactly what's going to happen in the exact same places, because it's just going to be the very forces that Ophira is sort of pointing to, that road that brought Zionism to the forefront and the white supremacy at the root of the very movement. I just can't imagine that they're going to learn any lessons from history at the rate that they're going, because they certainly haven't done it yet from what I can see. So
you are very optimistic.
I love that. That's the optimistic statement.
Yes, that's optimistic. I don't know if we look, if we look into history, whether, I don't think, there is a precedence of what is happening now.
It is unique
because
in a lot of ways.
And again, that's one of the reasons why I left Israel thinking I'm never going to go back, is because I felt strongly that such a huge population that insists on not looking into facts and the reality and living with this deepening cognitive dissonance. And here I'm putting aside being half Arab, empathizing with Palestinians in different ways. And I love them, you know, at least in my generation, we love them. We, you know, we wanted also to learn from them, you know, all kinds of things, especially from the Bedouins and, you know, and living and learning the secrets of the land, because they know they are the indigenous people, you know, it's obvious. But the fact that there is this utter refusal to have to forge a political power jointly with the Palestinian citizens of Israel, because it forces you to give up the Zionist ideal. You cannot remain Zionist as an Israeli. You can say, okay, it doesn't matter which flag it is, it doesn't matter, but we have to get along because we live on this land together. We don't have anywhere to go as a group. They don't have anywhere to go as a group. We need to find a way to live together with this kind of looming disaster of climate change and resource depletion and peak oil, et cetera, right? We have to prepare for a future. So we must solve these problems. It's human organizations. When I saw, I couldn't talk with anybody about it. Anybody. At least not from the Israeli population, but also the Palestinian citizens of Israel. You know, they were like, okay, you know, they had too many problems in order to think about this far future. But I thought Israel is heading to be a North Korea type of regime. And I'm afraid this is what is happening now in different ways. I don't know how it's going to happen, but all I know is that the Palestinians want their lands back. And they have all the right in the world. And it's they don't have to be angels. They don't have to be peace-loving. They don't have to be Gandhi. They don't have to raise a Nelson Mandela. That is rubbish. It's a huge group of people. They want their land back. And they are not going to give it up. And it is ridiculous for a nation, if you like, or a large group of people that says, we came here because for 2,000 years, you know, after exile, we wanted to go back. But these people that we expelled for the past 7 decades or so, you know, they should forget about the land. This is the kind of cognitive dissonance that I feel my own people have. And I think this is partly of what is driving this genocidal, you know, zeal, this genocidal mindset, because they realize they are not going to give up and now they have to force them out. And how much longer can you expect to be supported by world's, you know, powers like the US or Europe to an extent that will send you the weapons and in an era of climate change and resource depletion, et cetera, et cetera. It's like a recipe for disaster.
Yeah. And I got to say, I think that's exactly the right note to end on.
Yes, I know. I don't want to. I got great, carried really, away.
No.
It's so interesting, yeah.
If it's important, then it's worth getting carried away about. Normally, we would plug things at the end of an episode, but I don't think that's what we're going to do this time. I think that our position is pretty clear. I think it's very interesting to see this long, I guess I could just say what I learned, because that's normally what the person I'm teaching is learning about. I've opened up the world of the Indian Ocean Jewish history. It's interesting to see this long tail of shifting identities, of reacting to pressures, both internal and external, and how this story of Judaism, the story that I've been taught, the story that I think a lot of my Jewish friends have been taught, is one that seems so obvious or seems so innocuous or seems so clear and logical and reasonable. And yet there are so many factors that have shaped it, that it is to think that this is the one truth, the one story, is it's odd to me that even I, someone who is challenging narratives all the time, still kind of fall into that trap, which is, yeah, it's strange. And apparently it might be because of World War II, which seems to always be the story. So, Ophira, I want to thank you so much for coming on the show, for enlightening me, enlightening the audience.
Enlightening me as well.
Yeah,
you also enlightened me. It was very interesting to talk to you. And yeah.
So we'll be back in a couple of weeks with a much, it's not as intense of a topic, but we will be back in a couple of weeks with more Simulan related. So feel free to stick around and have a good time, or, and you know what, take a look at the High Holidays, because I think maybe some cleansing is what a lot of us could use in the world in tomorrow or the next day when it's on Yom Kippur.
Have a good year. Happy New Year. Bye-bye.
Seemingly Unrelated is a Life's Little Murder Board production. Created and hosted by Andrew Johnstone, audio production and editing services provided by Naomi Cohn. Our artwork is by Megan Zemet. The theme song is Irizumi by Pistol Jazz. To find out more about everyone involved and access the show notes for this episode, visit us at seemingly unrelatedpod.com.